So today's Bhagavatam class is from Canto 8, Chapter 5, Text 44. Yes. Namostu tasma upashanta shaktaye. Swaraja labha pratipuri tatmane. Guneshu maya rachiteshu vrittibhi. Na sajamanaya na bhashvada utaye. Translation. Let us offer our respectful obeisances unto the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is completely silent, free from endeavor, and completely satisfied by his own achievements. He is not attached to the activities of the material world through his senses. Indeed, in performing his pastimes in this material world, he is just like the unattached air. Please repeat. Let us offer our respectful obeisances unto the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is completely silent, free from endeavor, and completely satisfied by his own achievements. He is not attached to the activities of the material world through his senses. Indeed, in performing his pastimes in this material world, he is just like the unattached air. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. We can simply understand that behind the activities of material nature is the Supreme Lord, by whose indications everything takes place, although we cannot see him. Even without seeing him, we should offer him our respectful obeisances. We should know that he is complete. Everything is done systematically by his energies. Parasya shaktiya vividheva sruyate. And therefore he has nothing to do. Natasya karyam karanam cha vidyate. As indicated here by the word upashanta shaktaye. His different energies act. But although he sets these energies in action, he himself has nothing to do. He is not attached to anything, for he is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Therefore, let us offer our respectful obeisances unto him. So just now as I was reading this, that he has so many energies, the Supreme Person. He has so many energies and they're doing everything for him. And he's not attached to anything. And he's silent. And he's free from any endeavor. I was thinking, this would be very boring life. If you think for a minute. You have so many servants, they're doing everything, so you have nothing to do. You have no attachment to anything, so you have no endeavor for anything. You don't really care about anything. This would be quite a passive, sort of a neutral kind of a lifestyle. For somebody who's very busy in material affairs, with a great deal of passion and attachment and endeavor and anxiety and concerns, this would sound like a holiday. This is what a holiday is supposed to be like. I just sit back, I go to a very expensive hotel, everything is taken care of for me, and I just don't have to do anything. But Very few people would actually prefer this as their lifestyle because it's a little bit boring. So therefore, when somebody reads about this description of God, if they know nothing about His transcendental activities, they only know Him in relationship to the material world, it's very, very easy for them to become an impersonalist. To think that God, well, He does nothing, and when I attain perfection, I'll do nothing. He's not attached to anything, I won't be attached to anything. Everything will be very shanti. And so we see, especially in India, but all over the world, people come and they ask you, oh, you have a religious lifestyle, have you found peace? Because they think that this is actually the purpose of religion. The purpose of religion is to attain peace. But it's interesting to note that despite the fact that peace is valued so highly by people when they look at religious people and think, oh yes, there's a peaceful person, still, most people dive madly into the materialism that we see on all four sides of us. And they go for it. They try to get a name and fame and some popularity and some success and a family, and they try to travel overseas and they want to do this and they want to do that. And far from peace, they're very much interested in excitement. They're interested in stimulation. They're not interested in being inert. So this is very interesting, because here we're hearing about God in this way, very shanti, very neutral. But most people aren't really actually interested in that. And therefore, most people aren't really very interested in God. They're very much attracted to material activities, material energy, possibilities of enjoyment within this world. So it's very important to understand Srimad Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita, or any transcendental text in a very careful and deep and scientific way, and not just take it as a sort of a superficial daily activity to hear something and then that is everything done. I hear something, it goes in one ear, it goes around for a little while, it goes out the other ear, and I go on with my busy daily life without integrating what I have heard in the morning as part of my way in which I view everything. If this change isn't taking place, then one can say that someone's spiritual life at that stage has not yet become very dynamic. And if our spiritual life isn't very dynamic, then where will the dynamics take place? We're active by nature. So if our spiritual life isn't dynamic, then most definitely our mental, physical life will be occupying most of our energy and most of our time and most of our planning space. So listening to the Bhagavatam carefully is a very valuable sadhana. And that's why Srila Prabhupada wanted that daily we would hear something from his books and daily we would meditate on that. Once he was saying to one of his disciples that if you just read one page, you can understand everything about God. Just one page. And then in his own internal transcendental ecstatic state of mind, he said, actually, if you just read one paragraph, you will understand everything about the Supreme Lord. And then he thought further and he said, actually, if you just read one sentence, you can understand everything. And then he came to such a height of enthusiasm, he said, if you just read one word, you can understand everything. So when I was listening to this story, I was thinking, I can read books and books and books and understand nothing. So what is he speaking about? One word and you can understand everything. And so I had to conclude that this was his level of realization. This is possible because it is his level of realization. He's saying, you also can have this. But our level of realization may be far lower than that. So therefore, in a regulated way, we hear daily about Krishna, his pastimes in this world, and also his pastimes, as we see here so beautifully depicted, his pastimes in Sri Vrindavan Dham. Because without knowing his pastimes in Vrindavan, then you can't understand where he's actually attached. He's not attached here. Like, I might not be attached to listening to the Bhagavatam, but I may be very attached to something else. So he's not very attached to this material world. But where is he attached? Where is he very attached? Where is he very involved? Where is he completely not neutral, not standoffish, but completely absorbed in loving affairs? And that's actually in Sri Vrindavan Dham. So here, of course, the demigods are appealing to the Lord. And this is Lord Brahma who is speaking on their behalf. As you know, because you have gone through all the verses of this particular chapter, this is the first chapter, chapter 5, after the Gajendra Moksha story, which is the story about how Gajendra, who was King Indradyumna, in the form of an elephant, cursed to take the form of an elephant, how he attained liberation by memorizing certain prayers in his previous life. And by those prayers, when he found himself in a deadly, dangerous situation and tried his best to get out of that situation in great anxiety and fear, and realized that he could not get out of the situation, his death was impending, he remembered these prayers that he had learnt in a former life. They came back into his consciousness by the mercy of the Lord. And he began to pray them. And now he didn't pray them as a daily routine sadhana. He prayed them in a desperate way because he could understand that his death was just right there. So he prayed them from deep in his heart. And as a result of the depth of his urgency, the Lord appeared and saved him. So then we hear this wonderful story about Gajendra, and Sukadeva Goswami offers benedictions to those who hear this story, that those who hear this story will be saved from all kinds of dangerous situations. But that's not just a kind of a, you know, like when you see these big advertisements and they say, come to our store and win a free something or other, and there's a little asterisk and it says conditions apply. So it's something just to try to get you into the shop so you will buy something. So this is not that kind of advertising, superficial giving of blessings. But actually, if we deeply take to heart the lesson of the pastime of Gajendra, then we will be freed from difficulties. Because as Srila Prabhupada says, you will then start to think, I should also learn some prayers, just in case I need them sometime. I should learn the Nisringa prayers, Prabhupada says the Govindam prayers. Learn some prayers and say them regularly, because they may prove very, very helpful to you in a difficult time. So then, after this particular pastime has taken place, Sukadeva Goswami has given the final words on the pastime to Maharaj Parikshit, and he is anxious to hear more. So he requests Sukadeva Goswami to continue to speak. And Sukadeva Goswami begins to explain to him the activities of the Manus. So this again is an astronomical subject matter, way beyond our calculation, that there are 14 Manus in a day of Lord Brahma, and that these Manus rule for 72 yugas each, an infinite, almost like to us, an infinitely long a period of time. And within each of these Manus' lifespan, the Lord appears in a particular form to perform a particular pastime. And he explains about Raivata Manu, and then he comes to talk about the sixth Manu, Chakshush Manu. And he explains that within the time span of this sixth Manu, the Lord appears to perform the activities of churning the ocean of milk. His incarnation is known as Ajit. So Sukadeva Goswami is anxious because remember, he is on the verge of death himself. He has only a few days to go before it will be time for him also to pass his final test. And so he's anxious, but he's not anxious as we might be, anxious for our family, anxious for our health, anxious for our general well-being. But he's anxious to hear more. So he asks many questions. This is his technique. When Sukadeva Goswami makes a statement, he asks a series of questions to keep him talking, because even Srila Prabhupada, when he would give a class, at the end of the class, he would like to ask, "Are there any questions?" And then he would look around the room in a very dignified way. And somebody would feel compelled to put their hand up. And then they would ask a question. And sometimes when Srila Prabhupada was in America, the devotees would ask him in the beginning very personal questions, simple questions, things that we all know now that they didn't know, and they would ask him. And sometimes he'd answer them in a very intimate, fatherly way. And sometimes someone would ask a question on a completely different subject. They would say, "Yesterday in the class, you said," and Prabhupada would stop them and say, "No, the questions should be on today's class, because you should understand thoroughly this subject matter." And when sometimes he would ask, "Are there any questions?" and there were no questions, he would become a little annoyed sometimes. And he would look at everyone and say, "There are no questions?" And no one could think of a question. And he would say, "Ah, this means that you are all fully surrendered." And then he would feel more foolish. And then he would say, "Because the questions are meant to clear away all the doubts, so that one can fully surrender to Krishna. So if you have no questions, that means you are fully surrendered to Krishna." So this was the purpose of questions, to clear away doubts. But Maharaj Parikit, he doesn't have any doubts to be cleared away. But he's simply anxious that Sukadeva Goswami will continue to speak, because the more that he hears about Krishna, the more he hears, the more all the material worries subside. And we can experience this very same thing, particularly if somehow or another one particular day we come to the temple and our ears and our heart are open and we hear something. It doesn't really matter who's speaking, but you hear something. It penetrates through the active mind and the intelligence, and it actually touches us in our conscious state. And when we hear that, it can actually have a changing effect upon our life. So Sukadeva Goswami is continuing to answer the questions of Maharaj Parikit. So he asks him, "Why did the Lord appear? Why did he churn the ocean of milk? What came out of the ocean of milk? Please answer all these questions." So Sukadeva Goswami begins by explaining how the demigods, of course, became out of favor or cursed by... Does anyone remember who cursed them? Durvasa Muni. Because Indra became a little insolent, proud. And one time Durvasa Muni was passing him on the road and he handed to Indra his garland. And Indra was riding on his elephant, and he didn't take this gift of the garland very respectfully. In fact, he grabbed the garland, and then he threw the garland, and it landed around the elephant's neck. Now, the elephant, being only an animal, took the garland with his trunk and threw it on the ground, and then stepped on it. And Devasa Muni saw this and he became very upset with Indra and his pride, that he had become so insolent that he didn't appreciate the gift that he was giving him. And so he became very much disgusted with Indra and he cursed him. And from that time, we hear that the demons became more and more powerful and the demigods became less and less strong. And as a result of this, everybody became very unhappy. And so the demigods went to Brahma and they told him the situation. And he thought for some time, he meditated for some time. And then he opened his eyes and he smiled at them all. And he gave them his answer or his conclusion on what to do next. He told them that we should all go to the Supreme Personality of Godhead and we should fully surrender unto Him and definitely He will protect us. So they went together to the edge of the ocean of milk, Svetadvipa, and there Lord Brahma begins his prayers. And we have only a few more verses of these prayers before the demigods will receive the response from the Lord. So Lord Brahma is completing his prayers, almost completing his prayers at this stage. And so Srila Prabhupada in his purport is telling us that actually we cannot see Krishna. Well, we already know that, yes? I think everybody here, of course, we can also say we can see Krishna, we see Krishna in his deity form. But we cannot see Krishna who is behind everything. We cannot go out into the street of Bombay, at least I'll say for myself, I cannot go down to the central railway station and see Krishna acting. I see people running here and there and getting on trains and getting off trains and so much life and activity and people are there, but I don't see Krishna there. So to see Krishna behind everything, it takes a special qualification. Srila Prabhupada explains that one cannot be a fool and see Krishna. And he says that we are a little foolish because we think sometimes that everything is working without any superior guidance. This, I did this, he did this, she did that, they did that, this is going on, they are building this building, they are taking down this building, all these things are happening with some independent controller in behalf of each one. So in this way, we see in a little foolishly. And Srila Prabhupada also gives the example that if you go to a theatre performance, and your father or your brother are acting in the play. They may get up on the stage and they may dance and they may sing and you may not see your father or your brother there. Somebody else may say, that's your father. Look, you see, he's acting. But you're looking, no, that's not my father. So in this way, sometimes we cannot see how Krishna is within everything and without everything. And when we have a brief experience here and there of Krishna's mercy, we feel very elated, like that was very amazing. But actually, it wasn't amazing. Just like air, if we take a breath and say, that's amazing. That's amazing. Again, that's amazing. But actually, it's not amazing because air is everywhere and we're breathing all the time. We're supported by the air. So if we find ourselves amazed by the taking of a breath, then somebody else will think we're a little childish because it's not actually so amazing. It's going on all the time. So similarly, Krishna's mercy and Krishna's potency and Krishna's control is always there. And so the more we become, actually in this particular chapter it describes, the more we become situated in the mode of goodness, above the other modes, the more it's possible for us to see Krishna's activities within the material world itself. So there is one word here. Upashanta Shaktaye. Upashanta Shaktaye. Prabhupada, he defines this word in the verse one way, And he defines it a different way in the purport. He says in the purport that as indicated here by the word upashanta shaktaye, his different energies act. But although he sets these energies in action, he himself has nothing to do. He has nothing to do. This is what he says in the purport. In the verse, word for word, he says, somebody who does not endeavor to achieve anything, or who is free from restlessness. So this word captured my attention, restlessness. That Krishna is free from restlessness. And in thinking about this word restless, a very good example of something that is restless is the air when a fan is turning. If you've noticed, the air is moving, your body is moving, your hair will move, your clothes will move because of the movement of the air as the fan turns. So similarly, we can never be free of this restlessness, because the restlessness that Srila Prabhupada is describing here is the restlessness that results from the movement of the three modes of material nature. In fact, Srila Prabhupada says, speaking of these modes, he says that because of these three modes of material nature, they are imposed upon us and they turbulently move us as if in a whirlpool, and thus we are agitated. So here are some very graphic words. Agitated, restless, imposed, turbulent like a whirlpool. So this is the nature of the material world. And even if we attain for ourselves some peace from the sattva gun, we will see all around us on all sides and all over the world, we will see others who are being turbulently rocked within the whirlpool of material energy. And we ourselves, of course, experience this restlessness as well. So therefore, we also should take advice from Lord Brahma, who is giving advice to the devas here. And we should also try to develop the mood of one who feels protected. Very often, we speak of surrender. It's a very important concept. But it's interesting to note that Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur points out that the primary essence of surrender, what is the basis of surrender, is to always feel that Krishna is your protector. This is one of the elements of surrender. Without this understanding that Krishna is protecting me, how can I surrender? Just think, how can I surrender? If I do not think that Krishna can maintain me, how can I surrender? I have to maintain myself. Whether I maintain myself in a very simple way, whether I maintain myself in my mind, whether I maintain myself in a very gorgeous way, I'll have to do it, because who else is going to maintain me? And even if I'm being maintained very nicely, or I'm maintaining myself, there is always the risk of some catastrophic danger occurring. Who will protect me? If there is a difficult, dangerous situation, who will protect me? Therefore, I have to take out such things as an insurance policy. I have to do so many things in this world. I have to get security guards, security on the windows. I have to get a security lock. I have to do so many things to protect myself, or to take advantage of others' opportunities, others' offerings of protection to me. But if I understand that Krishna is my protector, only then can I surrender. So this is a very nice aspect of surrender. It's not difficult. It's actually quite sweet to be able to think to yourself, how nice it would be if I understood that Krishna was protecting me. How natural it would be just to do what he wanted, because everything's taken care of already. I don't have to worry. I don't have to fear. I don't have to defend. Everything is already all right. So this is the gift that one receives as one's faith develops and matures in Krishna consciousness. That gradually, gradually, step by step, one can surrender to Krishna because one has experience of His protection. And through that experience, one becomes confident that actually I can take further steps towards Him without fear. So here we have the demigods approaching for their protection, and we should read when we do this chapter, this is like a mega movie, this churning of the ocean of milk. It's like a maha, big production. So we should take advantage of this story to note in how many ways, you note how many ways He comes, in how many forms He comes, and how He pushes on this leela in so many ways. And then we can understand from this, if we think deeply and study deeply the Bhagavatam, that actually He must be doing that even now. He must be always doing that. And my problem is one. I cannot see Him. And if I could see Him, I think it would be much easier for me to surrender to Him. So we should discover what is the process of learning how to see the Lord, how to see His activities, and then how to surrender to Him. Thank you very much. Does anyone have any questions? Yes, Prabhu.
Hare Krishna. Thank you, Mataji. You made a point that if we surrender, if we think that everything is being provided by Krishna, I mean, take thing as it comes, understanding that it's Krishna's arrangement for us, then that is so nice, that is so pleasing, it's such a blissful thought. And but at the same time, for a person doing that, he could fall into contradiction that there are many services coming by Krishna's arrangement, but then I am taking one service, but then there is also another service coming. So then there is a question of choice and there is a question of priority. So how do I decide what is sent by Krishna is better for me or is more pleasing to Him?
Well, if you were working for a company, how would you find out? If one of the managers gives you some kind of a task, one of your employers, and another one would give you another task, how would you find out?
One of them would be my actual in charge. So I would do what?
And what would you do?
I would just follow him.
Would you maybe ask him some questions?
Yes. Can I also?
Yes. So similarly, there's two things. As we can't see Krishna now, and also for our general well-being, we have people who we can ask. But also, we should develop the understanding that I can also ask him. Why not? And then if I was to answer my own question, why not, I would say, well, if I'm working for him, I can ask him. If I'm not working for him, why ask him? I should go ask the person I'm working for. So if I'm working on my own independent account, then naturally I'll have to work it all out in my own head. Well, do I think this is better or is that better or how should I proceed? But if I'm actually trying to work for him, then I would go to him or I would go to somebody who's appointed by him and discuss it further if it's not clear. So the tendency is, in the beginning, for a devotee, when you have a camera, for example, or a better example is a radio. If you have a radio, you have a knob and you're turning the knob and there's no sound, and then the sound is blurry, and then the sound is clear. you keep turning the knob, it will become blurry on the other side. So on one side of not surrendering, a negative side, where it's blurry, blurry, blurry. But when we're coming to surrender, then we have to be careful we don't go the other side also. Which is, oh, I just surrender to anything. I just do what everybody tells me. I don't have to think anymore. No, you have to think. Even in surrender, you have to think. Because you have to be surrendering. It's not like a one time I surrendered, now I don't have to think. It's dynamic. So it has to be. So therefore, in an office, you always have to think that this world is a reflection of transcendence. So there are analogies. We can't, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur also says that you cannot see spiritual energy now. So therefore the Lord, you point to something of this world and you'll get an indication of something that can help you to understand something about transcendence. Even though the spiritual world is not opposite to here, but has different characteristics to the material world. But this is a reflection, perverted reflection. So you can learn something about there by studying something here. So you have to think and think. If I'm working like that, if I'm working in a company, if I have two things, four things, I'll have to check and see. And I'll have to present myself and be active in the decision making. And I do have the individuality to be part of that decision making. It's not that surrender means I become sort of passive. One still remains an individual with activities that one can discuss and decide upon dynamically with the person or the persons who are giving one guidance. But if they say no, this has to be done, then it has to be done. Does that make sense? Any other questions? Ah, that means everyone is fully surrendered. That is very good. Only one person was not surrendered. All right. Okay, thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Mm-hmm.